Again, good morning, everyone, those of you in the hall and those who are online, and thank you for joining me this morning. The focus of this morning's Dharma talk is to be a letter, an email letter that I received from a member about our upcoming landscaping beautification project of our grounds. Her view was very contrary and questioning about what we're doing. And I deeply appreciated not only the fact that she was willing to share her views with me, but it also raised a lot of Dharma issues that I saw in the letter. And so I received her permission to use her letter as the focus for the talk this morning, even though I won't mention her name or other personal information. Because again, not only does it raise issues of Dharma, but it may be what other people in our community are thinking. So here's her letter. Fred, there is something that has been troubling me. When I first received the group email about the new landscaping project, my initial thought was how nice, until I read further and saw that the amount you were trying to raise. Then I thought, I can't make a dent in that, so why even bother? While still staring at the email, all I could think about was about how this looked like just a big, huge expenditure for the sake of ego. I was wondering, who are we trying to impress? Are we competing for the most beautiful Buddhist practice center in the area? Are we going to be inviting more well-known and important speakers and practitioners to the center and want to make sure that we present well? I always thought that our grounds were beautiful and natural and very peaceful to spend time. And having been part of a group of people at a local church who prepared and served weekly meals to the homeless, all I could think about was a number of people in Tampa Bay who could be fed by a $160,000 donation. And that's what I'm stuck on. I can understand us wanting to make the areas that face toward the neighborhood more attractive as a benefit to all who pass by. However, do we really need to purchase high-end plants and flowers from a landscaping company? Couldn't we do without a pond or create a simple pond? I don't know. My vision would be scattering of wildflowers and planting lots of beautiful tall sunflowers. Is there not inexpensive greenery that could be planted as well? Can our designer make something with those tools? I'm not a gardener by any stretch, but I'm just trying to understand why this needs to be such an expensive and impressive venture. So again, many issues of Dharma, which I want to go into with you today, are raised in this email. But the first thing I want to talk about is, I think, is very central to this whole endeavor. And it's central, really, to Buddhist practice and Buddhist teaching, which is intention. What is the intention behind an action? Not the action, you see. The action is what is seen, right? And that's what's most obvious. But in Buddhism, that is less important than the mind of the doer, right? Because Buddhism wants human beings to transform their minds, right? To transform their aspirations in life and transform how they approach life, and not the doing. Because there's lots of times the doing can look good, but the intention, the hidden intention, may not be, right? So do we want to beautify our gardens? I can speak personally, since I'm sort of, you know, sort of the inspiration for a lot of this. It absolutely has nothing to do with me. I mean, I've never even given that a thought, to be honest. What is the intention? To create something beautiful for beings, something nurturing for beings. To create a place, an oasis, where when people come, even before they enter the Dharma hall, the meditation hall, there is something about the grounds, the gardens, that is peaceful, calm, beautiful. So this is the intention. There's no ego in this. There's no, there's no desire. It's not about trying to impress. And I want to respond to this because I understand this is the way of the world, right? Many philanthropists, they give, making sure that everybody knows they're giving, right? Making sure they're noticed, making sure their name, and even individuals. You know, we may be very small people, but we often want to, when we do a good deed, we want to let people know we did it, right? To let people know how good we are, how virtuous we are, right? You see, from a Buddhist point of view, actually, in traditional Buddhism, where you kind of gain merit for doing good deeds, you don't get any merit for those kinds of deeds. Or you might get a little merit because it's outwardly a good deed, but if your intention was tainted by ego, tainted by selfishness, right? There's no merit in that because the mind is not being transformed, you see. The heart is not being transformed, and that's what we want to be doing. So, in a sense, her challenge gets to really, I think, the heart of how all of us want to approach. Actually, in Zen, there's a practice, it's called hidden virtue, where you go out of your way to do a virtuous action and don't let anybody know, right? You may help somebody, in some way, do something kind, but you don't let them know that you did it. You see? Now, why would one do that? It's not a game. It's like, it gets right to that heart of this ego part of us that says, well, I'm really a generous person. Well, I'm really a very kind, caring person. I'm really a helpful person, you see? And so there are many people who could be involved in all kinds of good activities, right? And we know in our society, you could be doing good volunteer kinds of activities from morning till night, right? And that's good. It's better than doing unvirtuous activities. But yet, the motivation may not be pure, you see. And so, in Buddhism, the first thing we check is our minds. The first thing we check is, what's my intention? Am I doing this for me, or am I doing this for others? You know, early on, as you notice, we call our work here, you know, our members who volunteer here, right? We don't call it come volunteer. We call it selfless service. See, it's interesting. And then that's not just a feel-good kind of nice thing on it, because it's a practice, you see. To give service without wanting anything in return. You see? Without wanting recognition, acknowledgement. Good job, Fred. You see, that's the way of our society. And again, I'm not saying that if you're on the other side, that you may not thank somebody or say that to them. But from the point of view of the one who is doing whatever it is, to want that, to seek that, is not the practice of selfless service. Because the problem, not only is there that ego mind that seeks recognition, acknowledgement, validation, right? But what happens when you don't get it? Anybody ever been feeling unappreciated? Is that anybody ever feel unappreciated? Hey, they never thanked me. Hey, I never got a card. You see? Yeah, not appreciated, not being noticed, you see. That's all the ego, self. Notice me, appreciate me, more. Never enough, right? Right? I mean, we might have been wanting that kind of recognition since we were children. And even though we might have got it our whole life, there's still that part of us, please, please, please. Please, please, please notice me. Tell me I'm good. Tell me I'm worthy. Tell me I'm kind. You see, we're always looking for that external validation. Right? And again, it's not like that's bad. I'm not saying, but from the point of view of somebody who's trying to be free, a heart that's free, a heart that gives, because it just wants to give. A person who wants to help, just to help, you see. They don't need a thank you. They don't even need to succeed. Right? One of my teachers, a Tibetan teacher, who was, you know, in exile from, you know, been driven out of their country by the Chinese communists, and, you know, was living in India, totally impoverished, rebuilding, building temples, building monasteries, you know, doing rebuilding, right? And I happened to come back to America and visited one of his sort of colleagues who had come here and had a big center here. And he said to me, you go back and you tell Rinpoche, you know, he's wasting his time there. He said, the same thing's going to happen. This was back in the 70s. So the same thing that happened in Tibet with the Chinese is going to happen in India. So the communists will take over and all this building he's doing, you know, is all going to be destroyed and, right, same thing's going to happen. Tell him he's wasting his time, right? So I went, when I went back to India, I told him exactly what I said. And his response was very interesting. He said, he may be right. That may happen. But he said, he's totally missing the point. I'm not, this is not a building. I'm not just building a building to sake to build a building. He said, I want to manifest the Buddha Dharma. I want to keep it alive. You know, and my intention is always, that's my intention, and to keep the Dharma alive so it can continue to be of benefit to beings. Right? That's what I'm doing here. So it was a very, and he said, you know, and if that's true, and they come here and they destroy it, that's okay. I'll just build it somewhere else.
Yeah.
So again, first thing that really struck me here was this whole idea of intentionality and how important that is. And again, I was surprised that somebody could think that this is just a big ego trip, I guess by Fred or somebody or the leadership team or something, which is fine. I mean, everybody has their opinions and thoughts, but I want to make clear that that's not what this is about. So what is this about? So I want to talk about beauty, right? Because the other thing that you have expressed in here is what I would consider a very materialistic view of things, right? How do you help people? You feed them, right? And again, I'm not against feeding the hungry, but it's interesting. You know, it's interesting that when you go to Asia and you visit Buddhist temples, and if any of you have ever done that, you will see, traditionally, they're all quite beautiful, right? They're all quite beautiful. And they're often, and they're not beautiful just for the monks and nuns who live there. Lay people come there. I mean, I was very surprised that, you know, the same way, you know, we go down to the park or somewhere on the weekends to picnic, lay people go to temples and they do some kind of service, they do this, and then they picnic on the ground. They love to walk around on the beautiful grounds because they're peaceful. They're calm. There's an ambience within these temples and monasteries that is very touching. So we you know, to me, that was very struck by that, the way it's not just functional, it's an environment that also gives the message of Dharma, of peace and calmness and wholeness and beauty. But the other interesting thing is, and I'll say this more, because I spent a lot of time with Tibetans, Because the emphasis here is, again, utilitarian. If you have money, you use it to do something very material and feed people, right? Like this other isn't important. So it was always very interesting to me that most of the Tibetans surrounding the temples did not live in homes and grounds that were as beautiful and elaborate as the temples. And they didn't care. They actually they had a real ethic where once you sort of had enough means to support yourself and feed yourself and take care of your family, what did you do with your surplus income? You know what you did? You didn't redo the kitchen. You didn't get a new car. You didn't take a fancier vacation, right? You know what you did with your surplus income? They gave it to the temples. I mean, it was very fascinating because they really understood, again, these were Buddhist communities, the central role that the Dharma and the monks and nuns and played in their own life, you see. And they wanted to support that. They wanted to nurture that. And that was very interesting to me, you know, and because you would see these refugee communities, right? Again, where people were, getting by. And yet they gave whatever they could to the temples to build these beautiful temples, beautifully painted and Buddhas on, you know what I'm saying? It was really quite amazing to me. And to see the deep love and respect that they had for something that you can't put a material, you can't put a quantification. It's not worth anything, you see? And yet it was central to them. It was funny, even here in America, I led a retreat up in Gainesville a number of years ago, and after the retreat, somebody said, gee, you have to come and see this Vietnamese temple here. It has outdoor Buddhas that are like 30, 40 feet high. I mean, they're incredible. So, and I'd seen sort of a similar thing at the Vietnamese St. Pete Temple. So, and I understand what that's about. So I went there and I sort of asked, I forget whoever was showing us around from the temple, because again, the Vietnamese community is an immigrant community. As where did the money come from? These were not cheap. And you know what he said? He said, many of our people work in nail salons and they save their money and they paid for this. Right? Wow. You see? Very different. Very different. Yeah, so I want to talk for a moment about beauty. And the importance of beauty. This is, and I was talking to Angie about it, and since she reads a lot, she gave me a book called The Invisible Embrace, Beauty Rediscovering by John O'Donohue. I think here we're talking, my friends, big picture. Big picture. We all know the world we live in, right? It's in many ways, as a world, it's a dark world, isn't it? We have so many issues, right? Poverty with so much wealth, inequality, right? History of people treating each other poorly. We have people talking about the end of life as we know it due to climate change, you know, and major cataclysmic kind of changes coming our way based on our use of fossil fuels, right? And we have wars. We continue to have wars and armaments just pouring in and people still killing each other, right? Now, this is very important. So it's a crisis, right? In a certain sense, we sort of stumble as a world from one crisis to the next, you know, as we read the news, right? And as Buddhists, we want to look deeply. You know, that's the second noble truth, cause. We don't just jump in. When we see suffering, we go, what is the cause of suffering? You know, is the problems of the world, is it a problem of resources? Is it a social problem? Is it a political problem, you see? And based on how you look at the world and all the sufferings of the world and how you define them, you'll come up with an answer, right? Therefore, we need more programs, or we need more political change, or we need more, right, this or that. But what if at the deepest level, the problem of our age is a spiritual crisis? A spiritual crisis. Crisis of meaning and purpose and value, right? Of people who've just lost their way, right? Lost their way in materialism, lost their way in pleasure, lost their way in greed and self-centeredness, you know, lost their way in the pursuit of the meaningless, right? See, if you define the problem as a spiritual crisis, then the answer has to be in how do we transform and nurture and deal with this deeper crisis within the minds, the souls of human beings. Do you understand what I'm saying? And if that's the way you look at the crisis, then you go, oh, maybe creating places of beauty where people can come and be nurtured by beauty, by plants and flowers and trees, by the sound of water, right? By places that just walking into, immediately you feel calm and peaceful, right? Maybe those are very much part of the solution, you see. I mean, those of us who live here in Florida, maybe people, most of us live here in Florida. Development, 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 right? Our ancestors built parks. We don't build parks. We see land and we go, what? What can I build there? What can I develop there? Right? Isn't this what goes on in our age? You know? Who's out there saying, no, let's take those 5 acres and not develop it and build a beautiful park? Right? That's what people need. They don't need more restaurants, do they? No? I mean, do they, you know? Is that what they need? They need more restaurants? I mean, when you talk about this, we go, no, not really. We don't need more restaurants. I mean, that's not going to improve the quality of our life, is it? I mean, I have nothing against restaurants. It provides employment to people. But I mean, that's what we think, right? Is that we need more restaurants, more shops? Is that really gonna solve the loneliness and the emptiness of so many people? You know? Or do people need places, oases of peace and calmness that can nurture them, restore them? Right. So, to me, when we are I know $130,000 is a lot of money. But, you know, as a culture, we have no problem spending $1 trillion for war, do we? Do we? Just like that. Right? Just like that. But spend $120,000, $30,000 for plants, like that's a waste. Now, I don't say that pejoratively. It's just like, it's interesting, you see, how we've kind of shifted in where we're looking. You know, we need to see bigger issues. You know, but one of the interesting things, I never read the quote from here. The human soul is hungry for beauty. We seek it everywhere, in landscape, music, art, furniture, gardening, companionship, love, religion, and ourselves. When we experience the beautiful, there's a sense of homecoming. Some of our most wonderful memories of the beautiful places where we felt immediately at home. We feel most alive in the presence of the beautiful, for it meets the needs of the soul. Our current age, some natural ease has been broken. Our trust in the future has lost its innocence. We now know that anything can happen from one minute to the next. We are suddenly thrown back on ourselves. Politics, religion, economics, institutions of family and community all have become abruptly unsure. So he's saying the same thing I said, forgive me. At first, it sounds completely naive to suggest that now might be the time to invoke and awaken beauty. And he said, this is from the introduction to the book. Yet this is exactly the claim this book explores. Why? Because there is nowhere else to turn and we are desperate. It is because we have so disastrously neglected the beautiful that we now find ourselves in such a terrible crisis. So this is, I think, very important for us, you know, to look at, because, you know, big picture, you see. And again, I'm all for feeding the homeless, please. But it's, you know, we can keep reacting, you see, reacting, you know, going from one crisis to the next crisis, one difficulty to the next, one homeless person to the next, one social problem to the next, right? jumping one after the other, and never stop and go, what is going on here? Let us stop. What is going on? What is the problem in the world, in society? And how can I as an individual or we as a community do something different? You see, do something different. And I would say, yeah, I mean, we have our Dharma, we have so many different things that we offer. But I would also say, that's why I was very happy when we found this rundown, dilapidated church on Nebraska Avenue. I thought, how wonderful. On this street of such sorrow, and it's changing now, but of primarily auto body shops and auto sales shops. What a place to build an oasis of beauty, to nurture people. You know, this is the spot. So, so to me, that's this landscaping project and what we're doing, which is, again, I don't, in terms of cost, it's not all that much money collectively what we're doing. But I think it'll you know, nurture the people who come here. Just, you know, we have 350 members, we have lots of programs, people come, and they'll be here for the future, right? The same way when we go to parks, we are enjoying the gifts of our ancestors who thought about us, right? It is because of them that there are still beautiful spaces in the world, right? National parks, whatever. So there's no reason that history has to end, right? And that we can't continue in that tradition of creating beautiful spaces. And then I do want to open this up. The last thing that struck me, was her statement about, so you're spending this money, how does that compare to spending it on the homeless, right? And how many could you feed for that? And I reflected on that. I thought, well, that's very interesting, you see. And very personal, you see. Because it really asks, again, it asks a question. I mean, again, understanding there are many people who still live in poverty and still feeding, housing, the basic needs is still a struggle. But for those who have a little more than that, right? From a little more to a lot more, right? Then how we spend our money is an interesting thing to reflect on, isn't it? You know what I'm saying? And what's our criteria? I mean, because I was thinking, see, again, in the Buddhist tradition, there's the fourfold sangha. There's monks and nuns, and there's laymen and lay people. Monks and nuns, they made their choice. They have no money. They have no personal bank accounts. They're allowed to have three robes. I mean, they've made their choice, you see. So they don't have to deal with these kinds of issues. Disposable income. Where am I going to go on vacation? You know what I mean? Do I need a new fridge? Right? They don't have to deal with these issues. They probably do collectively. But we do, you see. And so I thought, well, what is our criteria? I mean, if my criteria was in everything I did, could this money be used to feed the people in poverty? Well, I probably wouldn't be doing, I mean, what would I, you know what I'm saying? I mean, I could go shopping and only buy the most essential things and think, anything a little extra, a little better, a little this, or a little more, I could, use that money and give it away, right? I mean, if every time anybody went to Starbucks or you went to the coffee shop and thought, maybe this $5 I could give, you see? Or before you took a vacation, wouldn't this money be better spent? Or on and on for everything we do. It's very personal, isn't it, when we look at it that way? And I think in a certain way, it is, certainly we talk a lot in our tradition of living a simple life, simple needs, not being attached, etc. But, as lay people who, buy clothes and buy food and have social lives, and you know what I'm saying? We have these kind of lives. How do we decide enough is enough, you see? Especially in a society which tells us what? Enough is never enough, right? Isn't that what our society tells us? You can always want more, want better, want newer. So, if that's the social ethos, how do we decide, you see? So I appreciated it, but I guess my turnaround on that would be, I think it's a personal decision. I'm not here to judge anybody else. But I think it's we all have to find our comfort level, right? With, wanting to be, again, we are lay people. The Buddha gave lots of teachings for lay people. He gave different teachings for lay people than he gave for monastics. In his teachings to lay people, his teachings to monastic was, you can't have any money. His teachings to lay people was, if you are successful in life and money comes your way, use it well. Use it well to take care of yourself, your family, your friends, and if you have extra, help others. I mean, he was very clear that that's, he wasn't against wealth, you see what I'm saying? He was just saying, use it wisely, use it compassionately. So again, I think we have to be very careful that we primarily be concerned about our own values and the way we conduct our life, right? And that we try to live that with as much integrity and purity. But it's at the end of the day, we're not here to judge others, are we? To me, I support all acts of goodness in the world, right? If, you know, if somebody says, I'd rather give the money rather than to the Florida Community Mindfulness Landscaping Fund, I'd rather give it to help the homeless, you know what I'd say? Good. Go help them. Do everything you can. Do even more. Right? But do it without, you know, thinking you're somebody really good. Just give. That's generosity. In Buddhism, in the Diamond Sutra, it says, you know, we give without a sense that there's a giver and without a sense there's actually a receiver. It's just a pure act of giving. May I be of service. May I be of help. May all beings be free of their suffering. That's all. Is our gift really helping anybody? We have no idea, do we? Right? We don't know the condition of people, and when we think we're helping them, whether we're helping them keeping, you know, we don't know, do we? We don't know. But one thing I do know across the course of human history, natural beauty nurtures people. That's pretty consistent. Nature heals us. Many of our happiest times are in nature. So I feel more confident. You know, I feel confident in the Dharma because it's 2,600 years of helping people wake up, heal, transform. You know, I feel confidence in that. Do I have confidence in political and social solutions? Not really. Not that I'm against it, but they haven't proven to be of great lasting value, have they? So let me stop now. We have a few minutes, just a few. Take any questions. In the hall, there's a mic. And online, they can just... Okay, is there anything online? Just, or if not, we can... What? Mm-hmm. Again, I was hoping I was very moved by this letter. I was very happy this woman said this, and gave me a great opportunity to look more deeply into this situation. Yes? Is there anybody online?
No, someone just said, please consider lots of trees.
Well, this woman put in a plea for the honeybees. Yeah. Yes, we'll do our best. You know, you can please some of the people some of the time, but you cannot complete all the people all the time. Yes.
Hi, Willow here. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say that I've just been reading some interesting books on brain health, and that you know, nature and sounds of water, I mean, literally create chemicals in your body that are healing. It's not something that we've just made up, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. It's this response to beautiful things and to nature in general. There's actually chemicals that the plants exude. I mean, beyond the carbon dioxide that, you know, the oxygen that we breathe, you know, there are chemicals that actually have healing effects on the human body. And I just, I'm all for it myself. The other thing is that you know, money is relative. You know, there's always more money out there in the world. You know, if you take the right attitude and you have an open heart to the universe, I think that money can be generated. You know,
good.
So I don't know. Like you say,
well, thank you.
$100 on weapons. Let's spend $100,000 on plants. It's awesome.
Thank you. Juan over here. Bill, Dave. I mean, Juan.
So my question would be, So when we give, even just thinking that brings good karma to us, is that not the proper thinking when we're giving, just kind of detaching ourselves from the act of giving itself?
Yeah. So that's what Juan is talking about. In traditional Buddhism, okay, there is the whole concept of punya, which is like merit. Where actually, you're actually right. It's almost like you do get some, it's like getting money in the bank. There is an idea that, by having a pure mind, by doing a pure action, one is developing good karma for oneself, which will benefit one in the future. Yeah. So from that point of view, you know, that's kind of like a higher order ego. It hasn't approached egolessness, but it understands, you know, that having a generous heart, having an open heart, right, being helpful and kind to others generates good karma for me. Yeah. So that's good, but it's not as deep as it can go, which is a real completely letting go. Yeah. So I mean, we're all in different places, but you know, I remember when I saw the Dalai Lama in 1975 when I first went to India, and I just had gotten there, and he said, you're going to encounter beggars everywhere, right? They're ubiquitous in India, a very poor country, lots of impoverishment. So you're going to see beggars everywhere. And he said, giving them a little and helping them, he said, that's okay. But he said, the most important thing is your mind, right? He said, and this is what he told me. He said, you say to that, you look at the person and you in your mind, as you give to them, you say, at this point, I can only give you 5 rupees. But at some point, when I am a Buddha, I will have the ability to liberate you from all your suffering. You know. So even because one of these things she said was, this is the mind training. So she said in the beginning, when I saw the amount and I saw what I could give, I realized that wouldn't make a dent in the total. But you see, I would say, no, that's not the way to approach it. You would say, at this point, you know, all I can offer is $25. But yet, I set the aspiration that if at any point I have more means, more finances, may I be of greater help. See, your mind can be ahead of where you are in the present through aspiration, right? Right. Like right now, you're helping one person. Right now, only helping one person. But my aspiration is one day, can I be really bring benefit to thousands or millions of people? And you'd say, well, that's kind of ridiculous. But if you look at people like Thich Nhat Hanh, right, who just, you know, he was just one man, right? One simple man born into a simple life in Vietnam. And yet, because of his aspiration, only because of his aspiration, to bring benefit to beings and to help beings and his love of the Dharma, that he was able to accomplish what he did. And we can all do the same thing where we're at. We may say, at this point, I'm just, lost in my delusions, lost in my egocentric, neurotic behavior, right? Lost in my emotionality. You know, one could go on and on about oneself. And yet, I have the aspiration, right, that I will transform myself and I will help others, right? So you see what I'm saying? It doesn't matter where we are, wherever we're lost, but we can have the aspiration, right, to transform and to be of benefit, right? And that's really central to our path. Today, this is all I can do, but I have the aspiration. So that kind of moves our life in the right direction. Maybe we have time for one more. Just, is there anything online?
I have questions that are
Okay. Any other questions? Yeah? Oh, okay.
No questions, but a comment.
Mm-hmm.
I look for support, universality of spiritual experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so I bring to mind the Native, one of the Native teachings of beauty before me, beauty below me, beauty above me, beauty around me. Let me walk the beauty way. And I think that's supporting.
So that's from the Native American tradition. Yeah.
Let me walk the beauty way.
Yeah, the beauty way. Yeah. What does that mean? Yeah, that's very right. Isn't that what we really all want? To walk the way of beauty in our life? Yeah. So we start small. We build a nice garden here for everyone. And we wish, may everybody who comes here be at peace, be calm, be happy. That's all. That's selfless service, you see. It's for others. So good. On that note, thank you all for listening. Want to thank the person who wrote this email to me. If anybody else has these kinds of comments about different things at the center or me, please, I'm very open. I'm very happy to get feedback. And, it made me stop and think. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Fred. Thank you all for joining us today. And we, all of you are invited online to stay for a virtual tea or refreshment after. So after the final bells, you have about 5 minutes, and then you'll be put into breakout rooms if you're still online. If you choose not to, please sign off. And then those on the room will have others in their breakout room. And then those in the hall are all invited to join us in the Great Cloud Patio for tea. And in both places, we can share, get to know each other, as well as share anything that arose for us during the talk today.